I am the aforementioned Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9 Placidus, New Mexico. But for today in Conversations, happy to have an accepted invitation from a gentleman who is involved in the money, and who doesn't want to hear about money? And it's also tax planning time of year for some of us. Some of it's, you know, April 13th. Some of us do it earlier or have other people manage that for us. But I think when I was younger and was married and had neighbors who were married with children, it's everyone says, you have children, you got to get a will. You got to get a will. And then all of a sudden, well, now we want to get trusts. And now some of us are old enough to have accumulated a few dollars and don't necessarily have the, I guess, the historical, it goes to the kids or it goes to the wife. We want it to also go to other places through charitable giving, either through a one-time or in perpetuity. And I guess some people call that an endowment. So with that, I will welcome Phil Missouri to the program. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation here, Matthew.
And you are a certified financial planner.
Yes, I am. I've been a certified financial planner. The acronym is CFP for about 15 out of my 20 years in this field.
And for those of us who are not, including myself, who don't necessarily know, who certifies you?
Yeah, there's a national organization that certifies us. The process is about 6 to 8 initial courses, and then there's a 2-day all-or-nothing horrible exam with about a 50% pass rate. So besides taking the pre-courses, passing the exam, you have to have a minimum of 2 years in and around financial services.
So is that the equivalent of like a 2-year degree as far as number of class hours or?
No, I don't think it'd be quite that much. I would say it's about an 8 to 10 credit hour type program. Somebody could work pretty hard and probably get all the underlying classes in 12 months.
Right.
And sit for the exam and probably be past the exam in 12 to 18 months there, Matthew.
But anybody who is a CFP knows what they're talking about. How they implement what they learned is up to individual decisions.
Yes, and there's a recent change also that says that person must have an undergrad degree as well. So a recent change was that you had to have that as a precursor to ultimately sitting for the CFP exam.
So when you're out looking for someone to help you decide what to do with all those bags of money under the bed, or maybe it was a time of life where your family left you a chunk of change, depending on how you define chunk, you're going to possibly, it might be wise to speak to someone.
Yes, and I think that the combination of the public press, pick any major newspaper, pick major periodicals, it appears as though the CFP designation seems to rise to the top. There's another designation called a Chartered Financial Consultant, CHFC, where you've got pretty much the same course background, but there is no national exam. So I think that the bar appears to be a little higher for the CFP designation. Yes, I think folks ought to seek people with experience with credentials as well there, Matthew.
And then where does the CPA fit into this mix?
Great question.
I get one per interview. Great question.
Great questions. Yes. Well, that's good.
So used
okay,
it up.
I'll remember that. You know, a CPA has their own education that's basically in and around all things tax. So a serious designation, not an easy credential to obtain. We have a daughter-in-law, took, I think it was 3 exams, very difficult exams, and then once they pass those 3 exams, maybe it's 5 areas, they also must then do time with a public accounting agency for 2 years. So a CPA works on the tax side. I would put a CFP as a generalist,
okay,
meaning I know things about wills and trusts. I know things about taxes, insurance, investments, So my education background is probably broader than that of most CPAs.
And I guess the fourth is a broker, like from a major stock. I'll just pick Fidelity because they're well known. So if I have a broker, if I have my stocks through an old employer, do they have to have any special designations?
So let me kind of back up. Most of us who are CFPs probably are also licensed as a broker. For example, I can be a broker. I can be an insurance agent. So I carry those things.
All types of insurance? I mean, health, dental, vision, auto?
I can legally work across all the insurance lines, long-term care, life, health, dental, vision. Health, dental, vision has become almost a specialized area, so I probably am going to work with somebody where that's their forte. But let me come back to your question.
Okay.
The person at Fidelity, whether that's an 800 number phone call or you walk into the Uptown Fidelity office, most of those people probably have at least some of the licenses I have, maybe not all of them. They probably have a Series 7, which lets them talk about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, exchange-traded funds. But they probably have licenses that are very focused in and around investments.
Okay. Then I don't want to lead the witness here, but we're going to say those are kind of the four legs of this stool. They all get... And then I guess we have to have a five-legged stool. Attorneys, they get involved with some of this too. Each of them, of those respective disciplines or businesses that you're in, get compensated in a different way. And this might be a good... I'm just trying to define our terms so that we can then get into the meat of the matter.
Yeah, let me even walk through them. I think most attorneys are going to charge probably a flat amount to do a will or a trust. A CPA is probably going to charge a specific amount to do somebody's individual or their corporate tax returns. The person at the Fidelity office actually is almost assuredly paid a salary by Fidelity. So when you walk in, you're not probably going to have to take out your checkbook. And you can get information, within certain boundaries there. In my arena... In the financial advisory arena, there's the potential for me to charge a fee, or there's also the potential for me to get paid a commission.
All right. But the services that you, as CFPs, versus a in-house broker for Fidelity, you can provide different services with different levels of education behind you.
Yes,
I guess it's a question as opposed to a statement.
I feel that I can probably offer a broader look and a broader set of services. So let me just, in the initial part of a relationship, I'm going to try to understand, is there a will, is there a trust, is there life insurance, is there long-term care insurance, how are the investments diversified, allocated? And I'm trying to take, let's say, a strategic view of all of these parts and pieces. I'm surely not an attorney, so if somebody doesn't have a will or a trust, I'm gonna probably refer them out to one of my sources. If somebody thinks they're over their head doing TurboTax, I'm probably going to suggest they meet with an accountant. So I can act as a referral source. To some degree, I want to be that prospect or that client's coach, maybe the quarterback.
Right. Makes sense. Now, if you have an opinion or maybe can share your experience, you mentioned TurboTax. First, I'll ask, for someone to make use of a financial planner, do they need a certain dollar value of assets, or do they need a certain number of children or a spouse?
There are advisors who have minimums. I don't have a minimum. So from my perspective, number one, I'm my approach has always been to have at least a complimentary meeting, probably a secondary meeting, where the first meeting is you're trying to get the information as open as the client prospect right. wants to be. And in the second meeting, I'm probably going to make some recommendations. From that point forward, then probably at the second meeting, I'm describing the path that maybe we can work on. But let me pretend for a second that somebody's all of their assets are tied up in their corporate 401k.
Right.
Okay. There may be no money that I will be able to directly manage. And then in that second meeting, I may give away the farm, so to speak, and explain to those folks, you know, here are my recommendations. And on the other hand, they may still want to engage me and pay me a fee. And then I'm going to try to work with them, maybe with an attorney or with their accountant. So most of the time it's money management, but not always there, Matthew.
Because I'm at different points in my life, I had been working, say, for a Fortune 50 company where I would have a 401 or matching whatever, but I was only allowed to trade within the family of funds that they offered. But I could have come to someone like you to say, review this biannually or quarterly, because Fidelity has hundreds, I don't know, thousands of funds, and there's a subset of that most employers allow. And how do you know? I mean, I was hired there to, you know, do marketing and engineering. I wasn't hired because of my financial expertise. So to ask all of these people to go, well, you just go pick the funds or talk to some guy on the phone in Wisconsin, that seems where someone like you would be well worth it. Now, as far as making wise use of a financial planner, do I have to have a lot of money, or can I be 25? Not to say you can't have a lot of money at 25, but most people are just starting their career. They don't haven't accumulated a lot of wealth. They may be on a life path where they're not going to accumulate a lot of wealth, but enough to live on and car and modest house. Can they make use of a CFP?
So let me take a continuum. I think somebody who's, let's say, 30, there's a set of recommendations that I can probably make to a 30, 35-year-old individual or couple. Their lives may not be financially too complex yet. But, for example, just married, maybe there's a child, it may be pretty straightforward for me to say, oh, by the way, you really ought to have a will or a trust. Because of that child. Oh, by the way, you should update the beneficiary designations because, by the way, you still have your mother designated when you're now married. Would you really like your 401k to go to your mother when you die, or would you rather have it go to your spouse?
That's sometimes a tough question to answer.
Well, yeah. So there are things when people are younger where I think I can still bring in value. I don't think it's as dynamic as maybe somebody who's just pre-retirement, early into retirement, maybe later in life when there are changes where all of a sudden they lose a spouse, there's a medical change. So I think that the lives of my clients who are 60 to 80 are more dynamic.
Right. Now, since we're going down life's highway and we're getting older, I have heard of some families where the parent or parents will say, I am going to re-deed the house, and I think it's in perpetuity or by right, whatever the legal term is. They still own the house until they die in some way. That may not be the correct legal definition, but from whom would they get that opinion? Would be from a CFP or a tax attorney?
They may get that recommendation. So let me give you...
We will remind everybody that neither of us are attorneys.
Right.
Or doctors or rocket scientists.
So...
I don't know, but maybe you were at one point.
I was not a rocket scientist.
Okay.
There was another lifetime before I was a CFP, but maybe that's a different interview.
Sure.
So I think that when you go to the house, ultimately talking with an attorney may be where you have to end up. Let me give you an example. The man has lost a spouse to death, and there's going to be a new marriage, and that person, the man may want to give a life estate to his second spouse. What that does is it lets her live in that house until she would perish, at which time the asset is then going to pass via his will or trust. So I'm not going to do the life estate document, but I might be able to meet with that person who's engaged to this second hypothetical spouse and kind of say, okay, this is a community property state. You have the right to title that house as joint property, but all of a sudden half that house is now your new spouse's house. Is that really what you want? So there are twists.
Not so much for the spouse's ownership, but for once the spouse passes, what's going to happen to it. That's why you wouldn't want the community property.
Yes. So, again, if we have the man who hypothetically has two children and he's getting...
Allegedly.
No, okay. and he gets married, does he want the new spouse, if he dies, if she owns the house outright, he may have just disinherited his children from that asset, which oftentimes is not what he wants to do, but unless he's made aware of it, he can make mistakes, so to speak, in the titling of the house that could potentially disinherit his children from the house. I'll give you an example. I had a neighbor, widow, and she had no will, but she had an 85-year-old mother.
Okay.
And that was it.
And the mother survived her.
And the mother survived her. And so my comment in initial meetings was, if you're deceased, do you want your mother to get 100% of these assets? And the answer was a resounding no. Okay, and it's like, okay, you have to do something. You must have a will in order to be able to make sure those assets go where you want. So had she died in that situation, her mother would have received all the assets, whether this person liked it or not.
And this woman, the daughter, did not have a will just because it was not part of her knowledge base, she didn't understand? Or was someone going, you don't need it?
You know, I think it's more out of this is not exactly, a fun thing to do, to sit down and kind of plan for your demise. And so I'll jokingly say sometimes getting a new set of tires for your car is actually more exciting than doing a will or a trust. Mm-hmm. I think it's more from the perspective that people just say, I'm going to do it tomorrow. So it's absolutely a mañana kind of attitude that says, I'll get around to this, I just haven't gotten around to it.
But there also has to be the emotional side of it, depending on your family and your temperament. You know, second cousin Neil, he was a son of a gun. He threw cake at me at my second birthday. I'm giving him nothing. You know, it's kind of this playing God from the grave that I think some people do. I have been involved with some people's, I guess their heirs, post their death, the will going into effect. And, you know, 1, 2, 3, boom, everything's fantastic. There's another one where the parents were trying to still control the children's lives from the grave and got really, really complicated in that, well, I'm giving grandma's brooch to my niece. Well, by the time, 30 years later, either that piece of jewelry was lost or it was given to somebody else. So it can be a real mess. You have to have, I think, a smart attorney going, no, don't do that.
Yeah, oftentimes I think folks need a team, so they need potentially a financial advisor, an accountant, maybe an attorney to try to deal with some of these issues. I think the physical item, the brooch, it can be almost anything. I mean, there are neighbors of mine who own, maybe perhaps a nice classic car that they've restored or something like that. There may be somebody they want that to go to.
Right.
And it's not going to go to that person easily unless they designate it. And an attorney can have a document that says, oh, by the way, this physical item, brooch or car,
right,
goes to this child, this grandchild, and so forth.
And so, it may very well turn out where, you know, Larry, who is inheriting this, I've always hated that car. I didn't. Now, what do I do with it?
Well, I think from the grave, the answer is you can't do too much. I think there's a more common item, and that is along the following lines. So let me do the hypothetical family for a moment or so.
With husband, the two alleged children?
Yeah, the two alleged children. Right. That's right. And so you have an alleged son, but you don't really like the daughter-in-law.
Never do.
Oh, never will. No. Right. And so let's assume that the husband and the wife have died and half of the estate goes to the son. Do you want to allow the son to commingle that money with his spouse's money, in which case if they get divorced, the daughter-in-law is going to have a right to half of that asset that technically came from her in-laws? Or do you want to control it from the grave to say that son has access to money through a trust structure for the rest of his life, and you can write that trust any way you want. You can even say, okay, at age 70, it goes outright. So you can put some handcuffs on assets going to your son, this hypothetical son, so that he can't, in a way, lose control of that money inadvertently or because he loves his wife so much.
As the decades go on, families have become more and more complicated.
Yes.
You know, second, third wives had twins from the first marriage on her side, and then I got a, you know, boy and a girl on my side, and then we adopted three other yes. people, and now we're all divorced. The kids are all old enough that they're legal. They don't have guardians. And then, so how do you divide it up? We, you know, Sally and I raised these first two children together. But now I've got new kids, and so do I just give everybody a sixth? Or you almost need a therapist as well as an attorney.
I like your term therapist. I think, in fairness, what those people should be looking for would be advisors and or attorneys who are capable of really not rendering a judgment or an opinion. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to understand those relationships as best as you can, kind of at arm's distance, and then kind of help those folks understand what they may need as legal documents to accomplish that. So, in my opinion, you're not looking for somebody who says, well, this is the solution. What you're looking for is folks who can just ask good questions and ask good questions and then go to the ramifications.
I think at some point, the people who are going in for the will or the trust consultation, back of their mind is either, I want to be fair, or my wife's brother-in-law, the stinker, he's getting nothing. You know, they're either vindictive or they really want to be fair, and it's hard to know what's fair, and not that we're going to solve it here.
I don't find there to be one answer. I think the reality is it's based upon those people's desires. Let me go to something that's somewhat common.
Okay.
The family owns a family business, but not all the children are involved in the business.
Right.
But they want those children who are in the business to ultimately be the successor owners of the business. And the business has a cash flow, or the business has assets. It's got a building. It's got land associated with it. Parties like that have to start thinking about, well, if they want everybody, and there's a term in our business of equal equals equal, meaning four kids, 25%. Equitable is not the same as equal. That could be that the children who were part of the business ultimately may end up with something of greater value as opposed to the children who were not in the business. So business ownership and family-owned businesses are complicated and messy. And
Mars Corporation, Walmart, all of that. Yeah, that's... I think you hit it on the head. And this is KUPR 99.9 FM, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson. We're speaking with CFP, Certified Financial Planner, Phil Missouri, a Placetan. So he must know what he's talking about. So we were talking about how we are going to dole out all this money we've got, or stuff. Might have five horses. Fair versus equitable, or equitable versus equal.
Yes.
That's a toughie for many people.
Yeah, and again, and those are evolving answers too, and maybe that's the difference between the 30-year-old and the 60 or 70-year-old, that I, in many cases, doing a will or a trust, it's not one and done. I find that many of my clients are going back to the attorney 3 or 5 years later because something's changed. Okay. They have a daughter-in-law that they've now fallen out of favor with. There's a child who maybe one of their children has a special needs child. Okay. So as the dynamics play out in families with children and grandchildren, oftentimes that means you better go back to the attorney and you better probably change your documents. Otherwise, maybe some things are going to happen that you really didn't plan
on. There could be a dog that the entire family wants. I guess many a TV show or movie or short story has been written about this kind of stuff, and which is why there is not one and done. So then, I guess thinking for myself, never sure of, is your will correct? Is it fair? Is it equitable? Is my trust correct? When would someone say, hey, you might want to consider a trust instead of a will?
Yeah, there's a financial issue tied with a trust that doesn't always crop up. So in today's day and age, an individual can pass $5.45 million upon their death to somebody else.
I just made it.
Good. That's good. I want to talk to your wife and you about becoming clients.
Okay.
A trust structure would potentially allow that number to double. So if a person has, let's say, between $5.5 million to $11 million, the trust structure is probably going to be the best way to try to pass those assets to whomever they want. Their children, their nieces, nephews, and everything else. So a trust structure ties to dollars. But a trust structure's other benefit is that it's private. So if your wife and you have a trust, when the first of you dies, whatever the trust says happens with your money is private. When your spouse follows you in death, that is also private.
Private from whom?
Private from the public.
But okay. Not from the IRS.
Not from the IRS. That's correct.
Nothing's private from the IRS.
So the accountant or somebody is going to help do the final tax return, but that's not public information. Okay, so your tax return is technically not public, as we are finding out kind of during this presidential election cycle.
Right.
Okay, whereas if you die with a will, and this thing goes to probate, okay, and your assets, your 401k, your house, your car, your dog, whatever it is, all of that is public record. So somebody with a will, if you have the person in the community who wants to understand, well, was that person wealthy or not, that's public.
But it's also kind of protects my heirs from each other. You don't get to know how much I gave everybody.
Well, that would be also true. So the trust, I'm trying to think about, kind of some of the structures. Typically, if you have a trust, if your wife and you have the trust, your co-trustees today, upon the death of one of you, there's actually what they call a B trust. So some of the assets are put into the B trust. The B trust is for this is how we remember it. This is for the person below the ground.
Okay.
Okay, and that becomes irrevocable.
Okay.
Never to be changed. Whereas the A trust, the person above the ground, the survivor, still has control over his or her assets. So in the trust structure, there's the beginning of divisions that often occur upon the death of the first. Whereas in most wills, whatever happened to that person who died, there isn't an entity unless it was, there's a twist on a will. There's sometimes a will with a testamentary trust provision. Let me not make it more complex. Right. Let me keep it simple as wills or trusts.
All right, so I have a trust with my legal spouse,
okay,
which in this day and age is somewhat non-gender specific.
Yes.
It works the same regardless, as long as you are married within the jurisdiction that you're living.
That's my understanding.
Okay. And again, we're not attorneys. We're just two good-looking guys. And when it gets, one of the married people dies, the will or the trust gets implemented, or do you need to get a new trust because one of the partners is UD, under dirt?
Yeah, the B trust.
Ah, B trust. I knew there was a.
Yeah, the B trust becomes irrevocable, so there's no changing of that trust document that's possible upon the death of that first. The person who is alive has total control over their assets and their trust.
Not what the B trust person wanted done with their stuff.
That's right. So
I can't say, that son of a gun, I never wanted him to get money, but my wife did. Tough toenails. They're getting the money.
Blood.
Right. All right, so we have a trust. We have a will. Is one smarter or just different tools for different jobs?
I think they're different tools for different jobs. Let me go back to the basic. The person who wants the will can get the will done cheaper by the attorney. Your point that you made, that attorney may very well be able to do the probate afterwards. The trust is going to be more expensive, more complicated to
upfront.
Set up. It's going to be more expensive up front. You walk into the attorney and say, I want a will package, because there's more than just a will. You've got powers of attorney. You may have a cremation document. You may have a health care directive. All of those same documents are going to work over here on the trust, but the trust document is going to be more complicated, more detailed. You got more what ifs, what ifs, what ifs. And then you have to fund the trust that says you want to put the title of your house in the trust. You want to put your account names in the trust. Mm-hmm. So there's follow-up work on the trust that does not exist on a will side.
Are we going to really muddy the water if we talk about revocable versus irrevocable trusts?
No. In most cases, living trusts, husband and wife, are revocable.
Okay.
I can go in and my wife and I can change it. We don't like this child, that child. We change the percentages. Okay. Revocable.
Easy peasy.
Okay. Okay. Irrevocable generally is the one of those parties is deceased, and that trust can't be changed anymore. You also occasionally there's something called an irrevocable life insurance trust, which is along the same lines. You've got life insurance. You've got beneficiaries of life insurance. You can't change that document, nor can you change the title on the policy. So, but generally, in the way we're discussing, irrevocable would deal with somebody's deceased and somebody's alive.
And I'm also thinking, Phil, that, and I'm speaking with Phil Missouri, a local certified financial planner. You are with Financial Solutions here in Placitas. Everyone I have spoken to knows you, so I don't feel like that's giving you a plug because they already know you. As we get older, we get closer to death. That's just the way math works. Is it like 1,000 times more complicated if you don't have a trust or will when you go into the hospital, not when you die, but you're in there and a one-day knee replacement turns into MRSA or something and you're there for a month and maybe you pass, maybe you don't, but you're not really able to make a lot of financial decisions, possibly. So are these vehicles a protection against yourself as opposed, in addition to helping guide where your estate goes? That's a big question.
So let's assume you just went in for the knee replacement. You don't have anything. I think the messiest part is not the will or the trust. The messiest part is, did you or did you not have a power of attorney medical? And what the power of attorney medical says is you're making your own decisions on the knee replacement, but this whole thing begins to go south.
Right. Okay?
The state of New Mexico doesn't easily accept the fact that your spouse who was sitting there, now that you have a MRSA problem going on, doesn't necessarily believe that she ought to have the authority to be able to be your power of attorney medical. So you may end up having to get an attorney to try to get your wife the authority. Whereas if you had a POA medical, you would have said, I'll make my decisions till I can't. When I can't, my wife will make the decisions. And if she can't make the decisions, I want my son or my daughter. So the scenario you're bringing in to me is part of the medical challenges today of, in my opinion, power of attorney medical, which is a separate document from power of attorney financial, are at least as important as the will trust. Let me just continue the monologue.
Certainly.
Okay. The power of
I get paid by the hour, not by the word, okay. So you can speak the whole time.
There you go. The power of attorney financial is a separate document. Oftentimes, you don't have the same parties in one versus the other. You're in the hospital, okay, and you're in for 6 months, and you're a single individual. So who's going to help pay those ongoing medical bills? And the answer is hopefully you had power of attorney financial. You allowed a niece or a nephew or a son or a daughter or your spouse to be able to go help pay those bills. But if you're in the hospital and you don't have a POA medical, don't have a POA financial, things get messy.
Right. And although this whole medical power of attorney, medical, I understand that they're also in different color paper in the hospital because they have different durations, and that's a whole other show, but it kind of ties into we need to be properly documented. This is not, loosey-goosey. This is a complicated world.
Yeah, the good news about having those documents is you don't necessarily avoid some of the family food fights, but you limit them.
The wills and the trusts, it gets more complicated because there are the right to life or the right to death states, or end of life determination, like I think Oregon and some others.
Yes.
So, all right, so let's bring it all home.
Sure.
To we're now old, our children have made their ways in the world, our grandchildren, if they apply, they're doing whatever everyone has agreed they're going to do. There's still a few shekels left over.
Okay.
Charitable giving. I guess you can do it throughout your life, or at the end when there's the big payout, charitable giving. And that, I guess, some people call endowments or foundations, or can you clear up any of those three terms?
Yeah, I think that there's, I'll say an onion, meaning that there's a variety of layers here. Okay? And people don't think this through the way they should as regularly as they should. The most effective way to pass money would be to designate the charity as part of your IRA or your 401k or your 403b. Why? Because the person who's going to get that IRA, 401k, 403b is going to have to pay tax on those dollars. So why not designate the charity as part of your retirement plan? Okay, so that's the first layer of the onion. Don't give it out of your personally owned assets. Don't give it out of anywhere else first. Give it out of your IRA, your 401k, because that's the cost-effective way. unless you happen to love the government, unless you happen to want your children to have to pay tax on those dollars. So
like in my IRA, where I have, let's say I give my wife 80% and my cousin 10%, I can give 10% to anybody or anything?
That's correct.
Like an institution?
You can give it to
like the Placidus Community Library.
You can leave it to the Placidus Community Library. You can leave it to the Placidus Artist Series. You can leave it to the Placidus Fire Department. You know, Casa Rosa, you name any of the charities here.
Or it could be the waitress that served me at the range for the past 10 years.
Yes, but she's going to pay tax on that as she takes the money out. So the first level is consider giving it out of your IRA, your 401k.
Right.
Then the second thing is, at what level are you going to be able to do this? A private foundation, let's just hypothetically say your wife and you are reasonably wealthy, and I'm making up a number, and you can afford to put $1 million into a foundation, and you want your two children to have a say-so over that foundation for years to come. You can do that. They would have control over those dollars. They're going to have to get it managed, but they're also going to have to do tax returns for that private foundation. So
right.
Private foundations probably work for people who can fund it with quite a bit of money. For people of modest means, maybe you just want to designate it to go to the charity.
Right.
Let me go to one in the middle. Yeah.
All right.
So I've kind of made a case for you got a private foundation, so the family's managing right. The money, or you just want to leave $10,000 to five charities in Placidus, it's over. You got something in the middle called donor funds. Donor funds are fairly new. Many mutual fund companies have them. I'm familiar with Fidelity's. I'm not trying to push Fidelity on anybody. But if you put money into a Fidelity donor fund, you can decide where that money dribbles out to during the rest of your lifetime. You want your children to have a say-so over the money. Fidelity has the final say-so. So it's not as robust as the private foundation, but Fidelity does some overseeing to kind of make sure that that money is being given to charities in an appropriate way. So that's kind of the middle ground of giving it outright to the charity versus kind of the private foundation.
All right. So if I understand you correctly, the foundation is a living legal entity.
Yes.
Where it will exist hopefully forever, designating this year we're giving it to the Placidus Artist Series. Next year we're going to give half to the Placidus Artist Series and half to the Hard Narrows.
Yes.
And the following year, Hard Narrows. All right. Whereas just a trust, boom, it's gone. They get whatever the trust says.
Yeah, you know, oftentimes in a trust, you're going to actually designate money that's going to go outright. You're going to give $20,000 to the Placidus Fire Brigade. That's correct. It's over.
Right.
One and done.
Are there different costs associated with maintaining a trust versus a foundation?
Yeah.
Because foundations sound like you need management.
Yeah. You know, the answer is in the foundation structure, even the people who are managing that money can get a salary.
Okay. But why wouldn't they?
Right. That could be your son and your daughter.
Okay.
But they're also going to have to have an accountant. They're going to have to be paying taxes or filing a tax return. So there's costs on a private foundation. Do I really know what those are? No,
no.
I know enough in a general way. There are no costs on the donor funds through, again, somebody like Fidelity. Somebody also could give outright. So if you give your money outright to Placidus Artist Series, that's out of your hands. You also could leave money to the Albuquerque Community Foundation. So ACF has its own charities, but you can provide some guidelines to them. It probably isn't going to be as controlled as you would have it in a private foundation. The children can probably have some say-so in that. You have the ability, once the children are disinterested or they're dead, maybe for ACF to kind of take it over. Frankly, somebody ought to be talking with an attorney and or with some of these entities before they would, probably choose to pick one of these approaches, though, Matthew.
Okay, and this is a good point to get to the how do we get this all to happen? If I heard you correctly, you would not be using the equivalent kind of software for will or trust.
In my opinion, no. Now, I don't have the right to give any legal advice. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is in probably various, in simple situations, getting a will or a trust online, maybe you're not risking much of anything. But frankly, I know of a couple that blew up. So when Dad died, the court decided that Dad's documents were not legally executed.
Wow.
Okay, right. So the daughter had to go ahead and kind of clean this up. And
So you're not saying...
Yeah, I'm not saying that everything you get online is going to blow up on you, but, you know, frankly, you're going to leave problems to your spouse or your family or to nephews and nieces. The cost of seeking legal advice, in my opinion, is pretty reasonable.
And then the, the third part of that would be the endowment or the charitable contribution. Well, maybe not charitable contribution, just write them a check. But the endowment, is there like form 103/A is the endowment form, or is it as free form as a trust? If I want to leave $10,000, now would I do a dollar figure? Would I do a percentage?
That's a great question. Okay, dollar figures can be messy because if there aren't sufficient dollars, so oftentimes in an IRA, you're going to designate percentage. You're going to say 10% or... So percentages are easier to deal with as opposed to specific dollar amounts.
So I want to leave a percentage.
Yes.
A good percentage to the Placidus Artis series.
Yes.
Are there forms to fill out other than what I have to tell my IRA people or with the source?
Technically, no. In other words, you put this in your will, your trust, let me go to the will or the trust. In most cases, the will or the trust do not dictate the beneficiaries on the IRA. So in the IRA, normally it's your spouse first, children or charities next. At that point, that's a legal document. It's a contract. The IRA itself would distribute the money. I mean, you have to get people involved, but that document would dictate that the 10% of your IRA is going to the Placidus Artis series, the fire brigade.
Now, so do I inform the beneficiary?
You don't have to.
All right, so when I see somebody here, and I want, you see on their website or whatever, contribute to our endowment.
They would like to know what to expect. Okay, so the local endowments, the title, a number of the organizations you and I are citing on this program, they would like to kind of know that when somebody dies, they're going to get something. So there's a couple levels. There's tell them nothing or tell them that they're going to get something without describing how much they're going to get or a percentage. So you can kind of dial that up or dial it down. You also can change it. Because if you're still living, that's revocable. So if one of these organizations you said is going to get 10% of your IRA falls out of favor, you can actually, at that point, then just take them right out of your your designation.
I'm not 100% clear on that because I have seen financial reports or statements that organizations will make, and they'll say, well, we have $3 million in our endowment fund.
That's usually that they literally have it there. It's there. It's in their bank account. It's invested. That is not projected money.
So that's not from my charitable contribution. That's from someone's previous endowment who died and it was executed.
That's correct. Executed. That's not dreamland dollars. Right. That's real dollars typically.
But they could have a whole chunk of change out there that they don't even know about.
They certainly can, and that's the way some of these organizations hope to grow. I mean, even the library where we're taping this, the library would hope that if they can't figure out how to raise enough money to do the second phase of the library, that somebody would pass away in the greater Placidus area who would endow money.
Who has already endowed money.
Or who maybe already has endowed
money. A Secret
Santa.
That's correct. That's got to be very shaky ground for the treasurers or whoever's managing these 501s, because they don't really know what's behind door number two.
Well, I don't think that they can plan on that dollar until it really shows up at the doorstep there, Matthew. Yeah. Even if they have a pretty good idea, so let's say that those donors have said, when we die, we're going to do X. My guess is, the present organization leadership probably can't be banking on that money.
Right. And it's, I guess it depends on your personality. I've seen within organizations that a particular event was sponsored by Anonymous, as opposed to me. I want everybody to know that I'm giving you some money, so be nice to me now. You know, everyone's just different.
Well, you know, and I'll kind of say, as I walked in here, I walked around the grounds of the library a little bit, and there are certain pieces that are outside and trees where you have in memory of so-and-so.
Right.
And so I think there are many people who do want to be acknowledged.
Or certain hymnals or a bench at the church is in memory of dear Aunt Tilda.
Yes. And some people might like to have that occur during their lifetime, while others would just as soon keep it private until they passed.
Or even after they passed, where Tecto shows up.
Or even after they passed, right.
Wow. So I'm nowhere near as nice as these other people.
You got all those choices, and that's why I think, whether it's financial advisors, accountants, attorneys, I think us professionals can help people navigate that really nuanced world we've been discussing.
Because there's some very nice people out there, where you go to a toll booth and you pull up and they say, oh, that lady in front of you paid your toll. Or you're going through, if you buy Starbucks coffee through the drive-thru, they'll say, oh, that gentleman bought you a cup of coffee. So that kind of freaks me out.
Yeah, there you go. I'll kind of say you must be from back east, because I haven't gone through a toll road here in New Mexico during my 34 years here, which is good.
The guy with the gun said that there was a toll.
Is that so?
Yeah. Okay. So I had promised that we were going to capsulize all of this. Okay. So we got wills, trusts, Trust B, charitable giving, and the endowments, so can make that as clear as possible so we can all get lunch.
I think the starting point is to sit down with somebody who has a broad set of experiences. Sit down, in my opinion, with a CFP, preferably in a no-charge first, second meeting. Lay it all on the table. Be as open as you possibly can. Let's talk about the wills, the trusts. Let's talk about your insurance, your investments. What are your goals and objectives? And let that person guide the discussion. And hopefully what you're going to be able to find is that there's information you need to make decisions. But I think a broad brush discussion is probably step one there, Matthew.
Makes sense. So, obviously, not one size fits all. Maybe the subtext is, if you have been fortunate and been able to accumulate some money or some stuff and your family doesn't need it all or you don't want them to have it all, there are so many worthy organizations here that need to go on as long as Placitas is here, which I guess is forever. So, if you hadn't considered charitable giving or endowments, speak to a professional and find out how to do that, whatever level is comfortable for you.
Yeah, and what I see is people give during their lifetime. There are many people, because to some degree the church or churches that they belong to have a tithing type structure. I do not see that same level typically written into the will or the trust. And that's a question, for example, that I can ask in an initial meeting that kind of says is, you know, are your charitable intents very specifically written out in your will or trust? And oftentimes it's like, oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah, you don't know if you don't ask.
Right.
Well, I think that I would like to think that we have cleared this up, or at least inspired people to find out more, because it's part of being part of such a wonderful community of Placidus. We're very, very generous with our time and with our money too. So I appreciate you taking your time to share your expertise with us. And anytime anything comes up you'd like to come back and share, certainly you know where to find us.
Well, thank you very much. I realize that a couple friends and neighbors, you know, suggested you give me a call. I've enjoyed being on the program and look forward to the possibility of being a guest in the future here, Matthew.
Well, thank you, Phil. This has been a conversation with Phil Missouri, a certified financial planner. We've been talking about wills, trusts, charitable giving, endowments here on KUPR 99.9 FM in the high desert of Placidus. So thank you. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you very much.